everyone. My name is Jalen, and on this episode for the Hotelier podcast, we have Michael Maffey. Michael Maffey is an assistant professor of management and organizations at the Nolan Hotel School. After graduating from Cornell with a master's degree and PhD, he began his teaching career at Penn State University, where he was a professor of employment relations and information sciences. Now he's brought his knowledge and expertise to Cornell, where he teaches courses on digital platforms and human resources. He looks forward to shaping the minds of future leaders, empowering students with the necessary knowledge to succeed.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Hotelier Podcast. I'm your host, Lucas Suero.
And I'm your co-host, Felipe Lopez. And welcome to our esteemed guest, Professor Maffey.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for inviting me to the party, guys.
Yeah, of course. We're super happy to have you. You were our HR professor last year and also an elective professor for a digital platform. So great to get to know you over the last few years. And just wanted to start off by, why Cornell? What got you here?
Oh, that's a great question. So when I was graduating from college, my high school debate partner, who had been the former debate coach here at Cornell, called me up and said, hey, do you know what you're doing with your life? And I had no idea. So I had been a college debater. I was interested in continuing to sort of be part of the debate program. And so I came up here for about 2 years, worked with the debate program. And that got me, it was part of the ILR school, which has got me interested in labor relations. That was a program that I didn't have in my undergrad. And that's sort of what began sort of my interest in here at Cornell. My brother also went here as an undergrad, and so I was a little bit familiar with the area, but that was really my first time being a part of the Cornell community.
Did you ever visit your brother here?
I did once. I came up here to visit him. He lived in College Town above the convenience store.
Very nice. Very nice. So what was he studying here?
So I think he triple majored in biology, psychology, and I forget the third, chemistry, I think.
Very busy guy, I can imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember in one of our conversations last semester, I think I was in your office, you mentioned that you wanted to be a lawyer. All throughout undergrad, you wanted to be a lawyer. So I guess I'm kind of wondering, what compelled you to go do a doctorate and then go into academia?
So I think the natural career path for folks who are in any type of advocacy or deliberation activity is you say, oh, you know, the next logical step is to be a lawyer. I really enjoyed the research aspect of it, where you sort of would dig into a position or public policy and you try to figure out what are the most compelling arguments, but also what don't we know? And that's really what academic research focuses on, is when you hit the edge of what we currently know about an idea or phenomenon, what else might be true? And how would you go about trying to discover that? And that trying to solve those problems are interesting because and I'm sure that you're seeing this in your classes, there are some questions we just don't know answers to. And they're important questions and they're pressing. And there's people's lives and livelihoods will depend on them. In some cases, there's the COVID pandemic, right? Like, how do you create a vaccine that, you know, in a short period of time, how do you determine if it's safe? You know, what are the testing procedures? These are all very interesting questions. And so as much as I like the advocacy angle, I thought the research angle was more interesting. And that's why I decided to do a PhD.
Great. So when you talk about public policy, there's a lot of work that actually goes into making it. But I think the difficult part is actually enforcing it afterwards, because there's always people that are going to look for loops around it or just ways to get around it. So how do you actually enforce these rules that are out there?
Well, in the area of the workplace, right, you can think about it as a layered process. Right? You know, human resource is usually employees' first point of contact when it comes to questions about workplace governance. They might also have a union or a union steward that they could go to. In some countries, there are independent judiciaries that are entirely dedicated to issues of the workplace. You know, in some countries will have labor courts. Here in the U.S., we have the Department of Labor. Some states will have departments of labor. And employees can have inquiries with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, so their state branch of that. And so it is, as with any regulation, as you correctly surmise, right, there are going to be gaps in people's access to justice, and there's active debates over what are the best ways in which we can provide that for employees. Because part of, you know, HR research has shown that when employees feel that they're supported, when they're treated fairly, they're going to be more productive, they'll be more likely to stay with your organization. And so how do you construct a justice system within an organization, right? Here at Cornell, we have like student governance, we have student appeal boards, right? If students are ever accused of academic dishonesty, they can appeal that to neutral third parties. And part of the reason why we do that is because we understand that there's both an innate desire for people to be treated fairly, but also that it's advantageous. Like you could imagine if Cornell didn't have any type of appeal boards and just had tyrannical professors who would be like, you know, you fail and you can't appeal, right? People might be a little bit more hesitant to enroll in a program that does that. And the workplace is no different. There's disparate debates about what is the best means of doing that? Peer review boards. For example, the gig economy, which is what I study, there have been lots of experiments about if someone is deactivated from a ride service, for example, what is the most effective and fair way of trying to resolve that if the worker and the company disagree about the underlying set of facts, right? And so in New York City, you had examples of peer review boards where drivers would be able to go in front of their fellow drivers, present their arguments, the company would be able to sort of present why they thought that person was deactivated. They're having similar experiments in Seattle. And so the question of justice in the workplace is still an ongoing one. And what is the most effective way of delivering that? And that's something that I think is interesting to study, and it's something that's also fun to teach about.
Right. So gig, right? What does that mean for the listeners that are listening right now, and kind of how does that relate to digital platforms? I know that's a class that you teach a lot about. I took that elective last year, and it really opened my mind to see that side of the world. So what is the gig economy?
Yeah, it's a complex question. We haven't really settled on what a firm definition is. But I think when we think about the gig economy, we mostly think about individuals who on sort of a job-by-job basis will source some form of work through an intermediary, typically called a platform, that will connect them to either a business or a person who is looking to hire them. So in the classical context of Uber, you have people who are looking to give rides are connected to those who are looking to hire someone to drive them somewhere. And the intermediary solves what's called the search and transaction problem, which is, you know, you could ride around in College Town on a Friday night, you know, saying, hey, if you give me $10, I'll drive you someplace. And I'm guessing you will get exactly zero customers, right? We need an element of trust. And that's what a third party in a platform can attempt to provide. And we've seen many ways in which they've attempted to do that. You know, early on, there's been things like rating systems, which is sort of the current dominant mode of doing the 5-star system. But even before that, you could think of like peer reviews, right? There's a platform for platform workers called Turkopticon, where it gives them information about the people that they might be working with as to whether or not they'll be trustworthy or not. And so the question is, how do you develop trust in this interaction? And that's one of the principal problems that digital platforms will solve. But digital platforms are not only in the area of gig work, right? I'm sure we'll probably talk to you about in a little bit. It also relates to questions of hospitality. Right? If you're a general manager of a hotel, right, you probably have a platform which you advertise on. You probably have a platform that you source customers from. Right? You probably have a platform that you might have staffing needs, like InstaWork or Blue Crew or any of the ones that provide short-term staffing solutions. And so the platform organizational form has become one of the most profitable, if you look at market cap, and one of the most dominant in people's lives. And so part of the reason why I'm excited to teach that class, and great students who take that class, is that it gives us an opportunity to talk about a new organizational form, sort of an old but technologically enabled one, and how it is changing our understanding of both social interactions and business interactions today.
Awesome. I'd love to ask you about the food delivery platforms, because I know this is definitely, out of all the gig economy platforms that students use, I think this is probably the most common. And there's been a lot of people that say that a profitable food delivery platform is a myth, and that something has to give in terms of the worker delivering the food, the person paying either an egregious amount of money for the food, or the company not making money, the platform not making money. So I guess I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, I guess, food delivery specifically, especially as there's places like California or maybe New York City that are starting to classify these gig workers as employees and not independent contractors. So given these developments, do you think a profitable food delivery platform is a myth, or do you think it can be done while having obviously humane working conditions and paying the workers fairly?
Now, if I had an answer to that question, it would be valuable. That's it gets to the heart of the question of what do platforms do? You know, does the platform provide a sufficient service that it is able to return a high level of value to shareholders, especially at the valuations that those shareholders were promised when they made their initial investments into the service? And I think what we have seen over the last 20 or so years, 15 or so years of the gig economy, is platforms were attractive investment vehicles during times of cheap money. And part of what, as interest rates have increased, we've seen the number of players in the market decline. And the way in which platforms have responded has been to, you know, there's essentially three sides of this interaction. You have workers, you have the business customers, which is sourcing food from, and then you have your customers from the platform, is to try to gain value from all sides. Right, workers, you can lower the percentage of their commission or change their commission structure in a way that allows you to have a more steady revenue stream. For businesses, they started to gamify the ways in which restaurants appear within the app. So businesses that want their app to within category. So like say that you had a Chinese restaurant, then you want yours to be the first one listed. Well, you have to agree to a higher, in some of them, you have to agree to a higher percentage that goes back to the platform. And so they're starting to now sell real estate space in the same way in which you have like Kayak does the same thing for flights and hotels. And then you have customers, which is that they can raise the fees on customers as a way to try to gain value from each side. Now, all of this comes down to a question of what are your alternatives? So if you're in a really tight labor market, then you're not going to be able to reduce commissions on the labor side that well. And this is something that all the platforms ran into during the pandemic, was during a very high labor market, during having a public policy shift towards having unemployment insurance that was being covered for gig workers. Now you have that side of the labor market that is becoming tighter and you're unable to draw as much value away from that. If you have businesses that are either using their own delivery fees or if people are ordering out less, then they're going to be less likely. They're less dependent on your service as a key part of their revenue. And customers, what are their alternatives, right? Do they start to learn to cook? I know that sounds horrifying for college students, right? But like, do they begin meal planning? Like, at what point do you start to have a drop off? What are the relevant alternatives? And that's a particular challenge for things like food delivery over transportation, because in transportation, what has happened in sort of from 2010 to about 2020 in many cities has been the public transportation and investment in public transportation has declined. Right, so in New York City, you have before Uber and Lyft went in, you know, it was very difficult in order to find a taxi. Well, today, you know, about a third of all taxi medallions are unused in the city. And so what that means is that as the number of relevant alternatives have declined, it has increased the market power of the intermediary in order to raise rates and to be able to gain greater value from all three sides. But it's a question of bargaining power, and food delivery is an especially challenging one because essentially all three sides of the platform have reasonable alternatives that make it difficult for the intermediary in it to be able to gain the value that they want to be able to return to their shareholders.
Right. So you talk about like a third of these medallions are now being unused mm-hmm. when after Lyft and Uber kind of were implemented into the market. Mm-hmm. What other difficulties came from them coming in?
Oh, I mean, anytime you increase the number of vehicles on the street, you're going to have a number of questions that will come up, both public policy questions and sort of externalities. What's interesting is that if you go back to the beginning of the introduction of the internal combustion engine in New York City, there's a strong parallel between what we saw with rideshare and what we saw with the emergence of taxis. And so, like, initially, when taxis came in, I think it was around 1905, Harry Allen brought them over from France. There is a strong prosperity in the industry. Right? People were getting great wages. So, on the one-year anniversary, the owner, Harry Allen, gave all of his drivers a gold watch, labor peace, because customers loved him. And then a few years later, gas prices increased. And because drivers had to pay for gas out of their own pocket, it created the first labor dispute in the industry. And more competitors entered the industry. And you had sort of vigilante violence where people were smashing each other's headlights to make it so they couldn't work at night. And if you fast forward about 100 years, right, Uber and Lyft come into New York City. And you could take a New York Times article from the early 1900s and read it, and it was basically the same concerns, right? You had too many idle vehicles, right? You had increasing traffic incidents. And so you have congestion, you have sort of concerns around emissions. There's all different public policy challenges when you change your transportation infrastructure from a more mass transit model with sort of buses and MTA to private vehicles. And so, I mean, that's not to say that Uber and Lyft are 100% responsible for this, right? It's just that whenever there are shifts from one style of transit to another, you're going to run into some of these public policy challenges.
Right, and one of the things that I found interesting is that Uber and Lyft are kind of changing rules and policies that are in place. So, for example, I flew to Peru, and I got there, and I ordered an Uber. And one of the rules that was put in place is that Ubers can no longer pick up from the airport. So I actually had to walk 15 minutes away from the airport to one of the parking lots to actually get in my Uber. And just finding these kind of intricacies are very interesting, because I remember some Ubers try and break that rule and they pull up to where the gate is or where you exit. And there's actually cops that are stationed there to make sure that Ubers can't sit there and wait. And so there's all these like little challenges that are kind of arising out of this.
Yeah. And I think it's important to emphasize, like, they're solving a really important issue, which is how do you create a fluctuating transportation system that matches consumer demand? Because so here in Ithaca, I was up here before Uber and Lyft were operating in the area, and it was basically impossible to get a taxi because there was, only a few taxis that worked in town, because how do you support yourself or support a business when the population declines by like 90% for 4 months out of the year, right? It's very difficult. So you need some sort of way of scaling your labor force dynamically in order to match the changes in demand, similar to New York City, right? Because in rush hour, you're going to have much more demand, or when it rains, you'll have much higher demand, which is the critical problem that platforms can solve with their model. The dispute is over what you've identified, so institutional players. So like taxis will want to defend sort of that there are certain zones in which they want to be able to maintain airport rides. Those are super profitable, for example. And so that you can use public pressure, you can use public policy in order to try to carve out that part of the business in order to try to defend your territory, to try to prevent it from being, to having to compete with alternative business models. But it does raise questions about things like labor standards, right? Like should there be a minimum wage or not? Like New York City has a minimum wage for ride share. Other cities, certainly like Ithaca, do not. And it's really a question, like it's a philosophical question of if people are given the opportunity to work at any time and you will send them work, what is the division of risk between the organization and the employee? In terms of what is your risk in terms of making money or not making money? Because in the traditional employment relationship, the employer takes on the market risk, right? If I ran a car wash, right, and it rained, right, I still have to pay all my employees. But for Uber, if we ran the Uber car wash and it rained, right, like all the employees would go bankrupt. And so it's like, what is the correct division of risk between the two? And that is a question that we still don't know the answer to. We've seen lots of different attempts at ways that we can defer risk from one side or the other. And we've seen compromises on the part of the companies as well, that they've offered different labor contracts and structures and ways we should have collective bargaining even in the industry. In the New York State, Connecticut, some provinces in Canada have worked with the rideshare companies to try to outline different ways that we can incorporate traditional collective bargaining into the industry. But it's a question we still don't know the answer to. But it's an interesting one because it will shape so many work opportunities in the future as more and more people are. I mean, even I'm an Uber driver, right? I've made a few rides, and so like lots of people have experience in the industry, and we still haven't yet decided what the overall structure will be.
I'm also curious to hear your thoughts on. You could call this a part of the gig economy too. Are you familiar with the website Fiverr? Where you can get, like, we use it a lot for stuff sometimes, maybe even to edit a podcast episode.
Literally do whatever you want with it.
Yeah, you can they can draw things for you. They can design a logo. So I'm wondering how you think that division of risk, I guess in that sort of gig economy, is different versus like Uber. Because if you're on Fiverr, you can just lay in your bed until you get an email saying someone something bought for you. But with Uber, you're sitting in your car, maybe you're idling. You have to actually dedicate your time. There's sort of a fixed investment for Uber and other. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the differences between the two.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So when we think about the obligations between organizations versus employees, we often think about what decisions do different sides make, right? Like classical independent contracting, right? If you have a leaky sink and you hire a plumber, right? You're not standing over the plumber and saying, you need to tighten this part of it, or you need to do this, you need to wear this uniform, you need to use these tools, right? You can only work for me, right? Here's your work schedule, right? None of that. And so there's sort of the classical test of control that I'm sure that you're learning in labor and employment law that will begin to give you an idea as to where the market risk lies. On things like Fiverr, and like I've worked on Upwork in the past, you're really not told how to do your work. Or, you might agree to a time frame to do it, but it's very much a classic independent contracting situation where, you agree to the broad terms, you're using your independent skill and judgment, you're the one who's coming up with the creative ideas, they're not giving you the equipment, they're not telling you sort of, you need to be in this office space or they're this place.
No supervisor, nothing. Exactly. No one's telling you what to do.
No one's telling you what to do. Now, you contrast that. There have been other gig companies in other countries that have said, you have to wear our uniform. You're not allowed to work on any other app but our app, right? You have to agree to these shifts, right? You have to sign a non-compete. And it's like, okay, well, we're getting pretty close to a traditional delivery driver, right? And so what is interesting is that it's a spectrum right now. And there are some companies that require that, for example, one home cleaning gig company that no longer is in operation, they required you to buy all your tools from the company, and they required you to wear the company's uniform. It's like, well, that's pretty much it. That sounds a lot like an employee to me. But it's this gradient of risk that you've identified, and this gradient of who makes what decisions. And so I have an article on this that actually looks at sort of, there's a series of logical decisions that you can go from very low control to very high control. And you can actually classify platforms based on, are they a labor platform, are they a capital platform, and then sort of what are the decisions, who gets to make what decision? And I think that it doesn't solve the issue, but it provides sort of a starting point for thinking about things like this.
There was actually a recent, I think it was a East District of Texas ruling. It was about franchises. And can the franchise parent company, are they responsible for the actions of the employees of the franchisee's employees? And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, because this has gone, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, with the NLRB. During the Obama administration, they said that, pretty much as long as the franchisor has some form of indirect control over like how the work is to be done, they're a joint employer. And then, in the Trump administration, they rolled that back. And so I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this joint employer, maybe in franchises, but also just relating to the gig economy.
Yeah, no, you have to have Professor Lacani on and talk to her about franchising. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question, because that is one model in which the gig economy could go, would be to create a franchise model. Back in California, when the state was sort of increasing employment obligations on the companies, one of the ways in which the companies were responding was that they claimed, or at least I had read, that they were thinking about shifting to a franchising-based model as a way of complying with the law. And again, I think it points to the uncertainty in the space as to what will these tasks, because the task-based work does open an incredible set of opportunities for people who have traditional difficulties in the labor market. So, like, if you, folks who have challenges, whether it be certain disabilities, whether it be sort of the importance of elder care or child care, right? These are opportunities that platforms have facilitated. It's then a question, like every iteration of work, as to how does it fit into our existing institutions and laws, and what are the distribution of risk between the employees or independent contractors and organizations. It's the same It's the same cycle, just in, this time with an app.
Yeah, phenomenal. So one of the biggest things that I took away from your class, Digital Platforms, was the idea of trust and the different types of trust. Mm-hmm. Would you mind telling the listeners what kind of trust is out there with platforms and kind of what they mean and what they mean to the consumer?
Yeah, it's interesting that despite us using platforms basically every day, right? You know, whether it be logging on to TikTok or Instagram or taking an Uber or ordering DoorDash, you know, people aren't like, "Ah, oh, this is my trust machine," right? Like, but this is so. If you go back to like 2010, the academic who sort of first identified this was Rachel Botsman, and she identified that there are different ways in which people develop trust with technology, and sort of she calls it the trust stack. And the way in which people develop trust, it can be either through repeated interactions. So sort of like in the early days of the internet, we didn't have rating systems. But instead, people would just have repeated interactions with other people, and they would learn to trust them. And then they would learn to, like, you know, there was exchange where people would sell things and send them across the country. But as the internet became very large, we had to find a way in which we could collectivize our experiences as a way to facilitate commerce. Because for a market to function, you need to be able to have a trust in the transaction. And the way in which the dominant solution now is the five-star rating system as a way of collectivizing our experiences and demonstrating that the person that we're interacting with is trustworthy and that you're going to receive a quality service if you contract with them.
Wow, phenomenal. I love that.
I'm also curious to hear your thoughts on, I guess, how word of mouth plays into the gig economy. Because here at Cornell, I don't know if you're familiar with Uber Jeff, but it's an Uber driver that, if you're not familiar with Uber Jeff, he's an Uber driver that pretty much everyone has had at least once. And he's a funny guy. I think he drives a RAV4.
And he knows everything. He'll tell you the social schedule of every fraternity, every social event, everything. He just knows it.
So I'd love to hear your thoughts on how word of mouth has played into the gig economy, and because that was that's the original form of marketing is word of mouth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the original form of the gig economy, right? Like that you would know someone who would be able to drive you someplace, or you'd ask your friend, "Hey, do you know anybody who knows who's a good tax preparer, or you know somebody who would be able to, you know, install some drywall for me," right? Like. The way in which we sourced the gig economy is just think about the flow of information. What was originally within networks has now moved to being digitally enabled, and there are both benefits to that in which you can rapidly scale the number of experiences and interactions that you can engage in. But there are also challenges because the intermediary has its own set of interests, right? We've seen this in dating apps, right? There's articles in the Post and the Times recently about how they now, because they've established a market position, will withdraw people they think that you'll be most interested in and then make you pay for the opportunity to swipe on them. And it's like, oh, well, you've established market power. You have a very large population, therefore you're going to begin to, as Corey Doctorow calls it, platform decay, that it'll begin to withdraw value from end users in order to be able to increase the profitability of the service. And so it asks a very big question of, are we currently living in the best era of digital platforms and it will only get worse from here? Like, that's a hard thing to think through. But the trajectory that we're on, you know, Doctorow makes a pretty compelling case. So it's unclear. And if it's true, what do we do to fix it? Right. And then these are tough questions.
And wouldn't there also be the argument that any really successful company establishes some sort of platform, and then that the platform market is almost becoming oversaturated with so many? I mean, if we look at the top companies, like Amazon is a complete platform. You have people that trust the platform. They trust that your package is going to arrive on time. They trust that the credit card information is going to be safe, that my personal information being in there is going to be safe, and that every time that I pay for something, I'm going to get it in the time that I expect it to.
Exactly, right? So if you have the institutional trust, right, your Amazon, your Cornell, right, with eCornell, right, if you have an existing business like Netflix, you know, they used to mail you DVDs and they establish a streaming platform. When you have that institutional trust, you can then translate that into a platform. It makes that jump a lot easier because you're backed by an existing institution or organization that consumers will naturally trust.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Well, our time on the podcast is coming to an end, so we just want to ask you one last question. It's been extremely insightful, so thank you. But so with your current career, you've done a lot of great things, you've studied a lot, and you really know a lot about the gig economy. Now, moving forward, what do you think the future of the gig economy looks like, and what advice do you give to students to learn more about it?
Yeah, no, that's a hard question. Because the gig economy is, in its current instantiation, the digitally enabled platform version, is only about 15 years old. And so it's hard to make any strong predictions as to what the gig economy will look like even 5 years from now. Because if you look back 5 years, it's, you know, I mean, it just started operating in Ithaca 6 years ago. And think about how now students rely on it for coming to class, for ordering food, for grocery shopping during the pandemic. So it is hard to say. I think that the current trajectory suggests that it will continue to grow and expand. And the question is, what areas will it do so? So some areas that have not taken off as quickly have been things like corporate accounting. Right? There are platforms where people with MBAs will say, oh, you know, we'll do accounting work for you, or marketing. There is a platform that said that it could replace CEOs because they would hire high-level marketing and accounting and HR and, you know, strategy folks, and have them all sort of deal with a business problem and come up with a report. And they said that they would be able to, you know, the wisdom of this crowd will be greater than any individual. And so like that really hasn't taken off either. It seems like in the spaces where there is location-based service delivery has been the area that's grown the most. But I think that now that that is established, we may see it slowly creeping up sort of the knowledge ladder. So I've seen a platform for arbitrators, which is usually a very difficult industry to break into. It's one where you have to have a lot of experience or understanding of the law and of an industry. And now we're starting to see gig arbitrators emerge. And so I think that the thing that I would watch out for if I were students is to understand the trajectory, look as to how gig work and platform work starts to move into other occupations. And, you know, is there a natural limit, and where are the places where it takes off and where are the places where it doesn't take off? I don't think that it will ever completely replace work, because I think people want stability in their economic lives. I think that there's a lot of culture that can come from being part of an organization, taking pride from being part in sort of the mentorship that people receive, especially early in their careers. But it does seem to be growing, and it'll be interesting to see over the next 5 years to look back and say, you know, where did it take off? Where did the gig economy struggle to gain a foothold?
Amazing. Very, very insightful. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks for coming on.
This has been another episode of the Hotelier Podcast, and we'll catch you guys next time. Thank you.